Hello. Welcome to episode number 122 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today is special guest, designer, and now author, Jason Santamaria. Hi, Jason.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It is always a pleasure, sir.
The pleasure is all mine.
Jason is the author of a red book. It's number 11 in a Book Apart series, which he is a publishing house that he co-founded. Jason Santamaria, On Web Typography, forward by Ellen Lupton. Let's just get into it and start with the book, because I love this book. This is the essence of layout, right? Type is the essence of layout, the heart of layout.
It is. It's like the bricks in a building.
And you know, at the beginning of a project, like having an idea for the project is always fun, having a concept for a product or whatever, that's fun. But the real joy to me of this business that we're in is doing layout.
I go back and forth between just wanting to like position and move stuff around or play with type. And I mean, I think very spatially. So my favorite thing even to do in like a house or an apartment is to arrange a room. Like, where does the furniture go? That's my favorite thing to do. So I guess that when you put it that way, it sort of maps in a similar way. I like arranging information, whether it's type or boxes or pictures or whatever.
Now that's interesting, because if you visit me, I have stuff that I've put somewhere doesn't really work, and it'll stay there for 10 years. And it will always bother me.
That's the tagline of the internet.
But right, that exactly, because I have websites like that. Like, yeah, that never worked. Every time you see it, even when you're in a position to change it.
Yep.
I don't know. I love when you are in a position to constantly change, though. Your favorite thing now, would you say, is long term working on something, as opposed to being a consultant, writing and fixing it and leaving it to the client?
Yes, I think it isn't necessarily that I want to work on the same problem for a long time, but just under similar constraints. For a while it was when I was working at, you know, a couple of startups like Typekit or Editorially, I was very focused on solving one kind of problem with one team. And I think now I've transitioned into a new job at Vox Media, and I think it's more about solving similar problems with the same team over time, but not necessarily changing everything every time like a new client comes in the door.
Can you tell us what Vox Media does and what
Sure.
you do there?
So I'm very new there. Vox Media acquired Editorially, the team from Editorially, the founders, myself, Mendy Brown, and David Yee. And Vox Media is a media company that has seven sort of large sites for news right now, ranging from sports to video games to fashion and food and technology, all over the map, and some really interesting journalism too is happening there. And I came in as senior designer into a already very large product and design team. And we're still sort of new there. We've only been there for a few months, really. I think time will tell what my position evolves into or shifts into. But right now we're solving some very similar problems that Editorially aim to solve in working with their story editor and the way that they publish.
For those who might not know, because Editorially is now defunct, explain what Editorially did and explain that startup that you started with Mandy and those other folks.
Sure. Editorially was a collaborative writing and editing platform, which actually sort of spun out of A Book Apart, in that we were kind of frustrated with the workflow and the tools out there for being able to write and edit. So when we would get manuscripts in from authors, it was really sort of difficult to discuss text. either in line or over email and have revisions of that stuff and just be able to track it all. And at the same time, one of the biggest things, especially for us, was keeping it in some sort of usable format that we could either get semantic value out of when we went into composition or when we went into publishing an ebook, or, you know, just for archival purposes, to not have some proprietary stuff, you know, tangled up in everything. So we made it editorially to try and help solve some of those problems, the writing editing flow, keeping a good version history, and keeping good semantic markup and underpinnings throughout the whole thing.
But not typography. It definitely was not a typesetting app, and it was... When you were writing your book on web typography... Did you have control over the fonts, and did you write it using the layout you knew it was going to appear in? How did you write it? What tools did you use to write it?
I did. I originally started out in Pages because I started the book long enough back when editorially wasn't even a thing.
Right.
First off. So,
right. It's three years in the making, we should say. And it's on typography, folks. So that's you know, it's kind of like music. If it takes 3 years to write a book called On Music, that's okay because it's a big subject. I mean, on web typography includes typography and then the web and then web typography. So it's a lot.
Right.
You start with how we read. Mm-hmm. And the chemical things that happen in our brains and what our eye actually does and how our brain translates it, saccades and so on. So I mean it's a short book, but there's a lot in it, and writing short takes more work than writing long.
It really does. And I started out in Pages mostly because at the time the sort of commenting and tracking of changes was probably the best that we could muster out there.
Better than Word, would you say?
I think just a little bit. If you work on a Mac, it just felt a little bit more natural than Word did. But Pages has since redesigned, and it's kind of a hot mess now.
Right.
At the time, I actually changed the typefaces to the ones that we use in the book. And
I always do that too.
And I think
I can't write if I don't know the layout.
Yeah, I ended up eventually, either I did or Mandy did, I think, changed it to a different typeface, which was actually good for me because it. I think that I was becoming too precious about it because I felt like I gave it almost like the sheen of polish.
Oh, because prematurely.
Yeah.
And so you I've left a widow. I'll rewrite that paragraph, like that kind of thing.
It was mostly mental. Yeah.
Like you were setting something that had already been like setting a print piece when when it wasn't there yet.
Right.
Yeah. No, I get that. I get that. You worked with how many editors on this? Just one?
Mandy originally, but then Tina Lee took it over afterwards and sort of saw me through to the end.
What was it like changing editors in the middle of the book?
I think the only one that probably felt like it was the middle of the book might have been me, because there were even early on, I think that I worked with Mandy more at a higher level, just starting to shape and more than anything, kind of eject stuff that wasn't working.
Right.
But it wasn't until she left and I had a lot more work to do on it, so that when Tina took over, it was almost like starting again. Like I probably should have been at that point earlier on anyway, of having a more like clear picture of what it was that I was writing.
It's funny because at the original 3 years ago, you were giving a talk on web typography and I said to you, that should be a book. And you've pretty much written it. I foolishly said, this hour long talk expanded just a hair will be a 90 to 110 page book on web type. It'll be perfect. And you agreed, right?
It was we were both the same kind of fool then, because I wrote out basically what was in my talk and it amounted to a handful of pages. I had grossly underestimated
and I should know that because the amount of time it takes to present, I mean, it's a totally different medium.
Mm-hmm.
Presenting something where you're like, you chuckle, you tell a story, you wait for people to laugh, you show a slide. There's the silence helps tell the story. And mm-hmm. in writing, you don't have that. In writing, it's all words.
Yep.
Totally different thing. And you don't have people's reactions. Like, you can say something, and by the reaction in the room, you can go, oh, okay, they know what that is. I don't have to explain that part. But you don't mm-hmm. have that in a book. Did you?
Exactly.
You did a very, I'm sure this is a pretty widely known story by now, but you had a very unusual process for writing.
Yes. So what I ended up doing was, I found that I was having trouble kind of just centering, not, you know, getting to work and not staving off procrastination or anything, but actually just focusing. And what I realized is sometimes when I would go and visit family, in Philadelphia, that I would end up, you know, sitting on the train and working or writing. And it was those times that I found I could really focus. So I came up with the idea to make sort of day-long writing trips on the train. And luckily, you know, being up here on the East Coast, there's no shortage of trains and no shortage of, you know, easy train lines to get on. And I found, after some trial and error, I found a really good route, which is basically Manhattan to Albany.
Yeah, and back. That's gorgeous.
Yeah, because you're all along the Hudson River the entire time, and it's quiet. It's not a very heavily trafficked route, so the cars are fairly empty. And I would just put on headphones and write. And it's, you know, 2.5 or 3 hours one way. So you just write for that amount of time. You get a quick crappy lunch at the cafe there.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have to eat in Albany. That's mm-hmm. the only – no offense, yeah. Albany. Listeners in Albany.
No, it's a small station.
Yeah, I'm sure there's like some – fantastic restaurants in Albany, but not mm-hmm. near the train.
Nope. And I would do that and then just hop on the train and do the same thing all the way back. And by the end of that, you know, by the one day, I would accomplish so much.
You'd have like 4 or 5 pages written?
Oh, more than that. Yeah. It just sort of like flows out of you, especially, and I would do a lot of homework. I would sort of get feedback and sort of like load up with things that I knew I could accomplish. It wasn't just always a blank page.
Okay.
So that helped a lot too, about having some direction around what I wanted to do. And man, I would just get so much done. It was so easy to focus. I don't know if it's just the isolation or if I like to think it's just everything. It's the atmosphere.
Someone else,
the train.
Yeah. Someone else did it too afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Who was it? Do you remember?
I don't, but Amtrak came up with like a writer's program.
Based on what you were doing?
No, not based on me. I think other people do this too, but I never read about it before. But when I started talking about it, I would, you know, say something on Twitter and people would say, oh, you know, I tried that one time too. But Amtrak came up with like a writer's residency thing where you could submit a proposal and they would give you like a free round trip or something like that, like all across the country, something. To write whatever it is that you want to write.
Wow. And thus the earth gets defiled and polluted.
Yeah. Don't think too much about that
part. But my book is so worth it.
And then you also have to print the book and ship the book.
Yeah. Right. And truck it all over the world with fuel and fly it all over the world. But we're not going to talk about that.
Nope.
We're not going to talk about it because we have e-books. There's also e-books. Yeah. And those don't use any electricity or fuel. Yeah, I'm charging about 11 devices right now, just in this room. I've got like those little octopus things that you can just to charge like 5 devices at once, mm-hmm. and don't care what device you plug in, they sort of figure it out. I've got those everywhere now. I'm just like, I wander from room to room like some kind of monster. With wow. like a monster spider with like beings trapped in its webs everywhere I go. Like charging, good, charging, charge the So that was the process. Very beautiful. Did you ever write side by side with someone? Did you ever like take your girlfriend up and she wrote too? Or do you ever?
There were a couple of times that, so I would talk about how much I like this. And there were a few times that some friends tagged along. They wanted to know, you know, hey, let me know next time you do a writing trip. and, you know, I'll come along with you. So like my friend Frank and my friend Cameron, they would come, you know, once or twice, and they did the same exact thing. They got a ton done, and, you know, they were really excited by the end of it. It's just a, I don't know, it's just such an easy way to focus and shut everything out that I, for whatever reason, was not able to do very easily at home.
You're breaking up and sounding like, what's that Radiohead album where, that tighter, fitter.
Oh, OK Computer.
Yeah, OK Computer, duh, of course.
I think Skype is just finicky.
Yeah, we should probably say that what Skype does is very hard.
Yes, yes it is.
It's funny, I mean, you've worked on two apps, right? Typedia and, sorry, Typekit, excuse me, Typekit and Editorially. Mm-hmm. So you know how hard things are.
Yeah, things are really hard.
It kind of, you know, it's funny, people aren't saying fail so much anymore. Maybe everyone's tried their hand at a startup and realized. Remember that whole spoiled brat?
Oh, yeah.
Twitter thing a few years ago, people would be like, fail.
Everything is fail. Yeah. Yeah,
like the Windows phone came out, fail.
It's true. After going through it a couple times, you're right. I think I tend to reserve judgment a little bit more than I used to, and just assume that everyone you meet, everyone's nice and trying really hard to make stuff, and they're not trying to make bad things.
Some people are, sure,
but on the whole, you know, everyone's trying their best.
Yes. This is like, what don't they, either in therapy or AA, I forget which, but they say you're supposed to like forgive your parents and say they did the best they could, kind of no matter what. Probably therapy and AA. I don't know, but anyway, and it's true. It's absolutely true, and all of that. You know, when you meet someone who seems mean, I'm trying to instill that in my kid now, but it's hard because I do want her to take care of herself and protect herself, but I do try to install compassion, like. Maybe that person's being mean because they're insecure. Maybe they're afraid. Maybe they're feeling shy. You know what I mean?
That's a really tough thing to learn. It's a very nuanced thing.
It is. Are you on Twitter less as a result?
I am, yeah. I've definitely stepped back from Twitter considerably, mostly because I just couldn't. I really struggled with all of the negativity that was happening there, and that's not unique to Twitter. It's more about sort of the Twitter is basically, you know, web, like blog comments or YouTube comments taken even a step further. So there's more, even like more anonymity and fewer repercussions. And it just sort of can so easily balloon, and seeing my friends get attacked by strangers, or just even being in the world and seeing stuff like what the conversation was around the events in like Ferguson, or all of the like the feminist frequency feedback from Anita's videos. I couldn't take that so much, you know, in my face all the time anymore. And it isn't that I don't want to do anything about it, but I don't think that Twitter's the place to do something about it.
Sometimes you have to get on the train.
Yeah.
And, you know, participating less in Twitter can be a way of getting on the train and focusing on what matters.
Absolutely.
And yeah, it's weird because I have that mixed feeling. Sometimes I'll see somebody trying to solve misogyny on Twitter and I'll be like, it's not going to get solved there. And then someone will say, yeah, but if we don't call attention to it, then maybe it won't get solved at all. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, that's true. So it's sort of like, yeah, your t-shirt won't end the war, young man. Yeah, but if enough of us wear this t-shirt, okay.
It's tough because I think that for a lot of people, Twitter just wants to be that conversation that you're having around a dinner table, but it never is. It's the eternal counterpoint.
I feel lonely about that because I do have friends who definitely use it as that, and I'll see them like cracking jokes and cracking, you know, I always feel like that's a party. It's not that I'm not invited to that party. It's just that I'm not comfortable at that party. I just really use it as like, this has gone live. this just got published. I use it to like promote things.
Yeah.
And then I use it to like, if I think I've come up with an epigram or, you know, or don't use the subway, you know.
Right.
Today yeah. because of a bomb threat or something. Like I use it for that, like a little broadcast sure. thing. And
That's the way I've sort of transitioned into it. It's not so much a personal thing anymore. It's more like an extension of my own website or
whatever. Yeah, where I used to, one of the things I used to do all the time on my website was have links.
Mm-hmm.
Because there weren't that many places to find links about web design, and it felt like my job. And now it still kind of feels like my job, but I do it on Twitter. Because you're more likely to be there anyway.
Yeah, it's the new RSS feed.
Yeah, or it's the new, what did we used to call those, blog roll or the little...
The ring?
No, like the little, there's the post John, there's the Daring Fireball post that's actually a post, and then there's the two-sentence Daring Fireball post that's really a link. And I don't really put those on my website anymore. I say Daring Fireball because he's somebody who still does that, and he does it right. very well. When he puts something on Twitter, it usually goes back to Daring Fireball, where he says a little bit more about it, but not that much. It's really a link post. But I don't really do link posts anymore. I do I write or I don't write.
Yep, I do the same thing.
Well, you art direct your site.
I used to. I haven't been doing that recently. It's funny because I redesigned my site a few years back, and it has a lot more control and it has a lot more going on that it would allow me to do articles sort of at a step further than what I was doing before. But I found that I wasn't, that maybe that part of me, at least for my own personal articles, had kind of passed. I wasn't as interested in doing it anymore. And part of that, I think, was that I was originally just trying to show, I wanted to have some fun doing it. And at the same time, I wanted to show people that we could do a little bit more with our editorial design. And I think that either through some of the writing that I did or other people who did the same stuff, larger companies caught on, you know, larger publications, whether they're magazines, newspapers, whatever, caught on. And there's a lot more of that out there now, some really more like bespoke, interesting editorial design online. And I think that that's, I mean, that made me happy. I didn't feel like I needed to prove a point anymore, but that people had sort of gotten it.
I totally get that. You're absolutely right. You were one of the few people saying it's possible to art direct articles. It's possible to do editorial design. I know you're I just had the authors of editorial design on the show a couple episodes ago. I know you're in the book and you're a fan of that book as I am.
Yeah.
But you know, that's now, it's not the norm. Most sites are still sort of dumps.
Mm-hmm.
Where stuff gets shoved into a column, but it's more of a norm. I think you had something to do with that, and you should be happy about that. But yeah, it makes you less likely to do it on your own site. I mean, I know what that feels like.
And I think that I really loved, for me, it was actually, I loved the design end of it, but it was the writing part that I didn't enjoy as much because I was so connected to the piece, because I had to write it as well, that I had trouble sort of abstracting it to the point of being able to design it. I would almost rather, like I would still do this probably in a heartbeat if I could find someone that I really appreciated their like writing, and they would just do the writing and I could do the design, because the design stuff never took me
exactly
that long. But I think I needed that sort of split. Putting both of those on my shoulders was a little bit too much, I think.
And now what you do, right, so it became a roadblock to writing, which was already hard, and you already had this huge writing project, a book, making you feel guilty and like powerless every day. You didn't need to put more roadblocks to writing on your personal site. Personal site's supposed to be, I'm stuck writing this book, let me just knock off a blog post.
Yep.
But your job now at Vox Media, to some extent, is exactly what you're talking about, or either that or you're setting up systems to help other people do what you're talking about. You're setting up systems so other people can do editorial design.
But, exactly.
So that's pretty great, and you don't need to do it on your site. I mean,
yeah. And I mean, having more resources to be able to do it at that level, I think is really, really exciting to me. you know, whether it's photography or it just like there's so many more things to tap into now. And that's why I'm really excited. And I'm interested in getting into that portion of Vox as well, because I think that I have a lot of ideas of where this could go much further too, not just from where we are now. And I'm anxious to, you know, get some of those ideas out.
And I think I had my last guest was Justin Dower, Pseudo-Room, mm-hmm. of the Dead Pixel Society. And he talked about how when he was, you know, when he was starting, he didn't have a family. He had a lot of free time. Making icons 6 hours a night after work was what you do. Mm-hmm. And how now in their, I guess, late 30s, early 40s, some of them, they're beginning to do it again. Like as a almost like this was great. Let's come back to it. It may mm-hmm. be that 5-10 years from now, when you're doing something completely different, working on who knows what, that you'll start doing editorial design in a big way on your personal site again, if you want to.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. You also another of your projects that you don't talk about much is Typedia, mm-hmm. which probably helped you. It must have helped you to some extent write the book, and it also showed how much you love type, like always. That since I've known you, that's been the thing with you. Mm-hmm. Talk about Typedia a little bit, what it is, what you did, and where it is now.
Well, Typedia started out, I guess, this was another one of those projects that just sort of went on for a long time because it was a labor of love. I think the original conception of it was probably in 2004 or 5, but wow. it didn't launch for a few years after that. And it was sort of like, I mean, the prospect of it was like, let's make IMDb, but for typefaces.
Perfectly so. Said.
So not just like a Wikipedia page where there was sort of biographical information, but actually there's a tremendous amount of metadata that you can put around typefaces, and that metadata is powerful when everything else is collected in the same way, and you can link from not only serifs to other serifs, but you know, time periods or physical characteristics and group typefaces in that way, in the same way that you could genres of movies or directors or things like that. So this is a very interesting prospect to me, and one that I think still has a tremendous amount of value.
Yeah, every type book I've ever seen, it's mostly about the classification system, and everyone disagrees. Everyone has their own system.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you come up with yours?
Originally, it was sort of the working of Mark Simonson, the type designer. He spent a lot of time trying to come up with a decent classification system, not that we wanted to reinvent anyone, but one that just sort of worked in a more general sense. It didn't necessarily have to be highly academic, but it was more practical in terms of how you would discover a typeface. Not so much wondering what, you know, drawer a typeface would fit into, but where you might go to find typefaces that look like something.
That had to influence the way you approach Typekit as well.
It absolutely did. And I think one of the last big things I did there before I left was redesign the interface to browse through the typefaces. And if you go to Typekit now, in the sidebar, there's a sort of very visual system of buttons with a very loose classification of serifs and sans serifs and stuff like that. And that was very much influenced by some of the work from Typedia, because I realized that in order for people to actually want to use something and for them to understand it, it didn't have to be a completely academic exercise. It had to be a more practical exercise.
For use. Designed for use. How would I use this? Which is also something you treat quite extensively in the book.
Right.
Don't go, I'm just going to look at these fonts and find what I like, but think about what am I using this for? How am I communicating? What am I communicating? And start with that. I just want to talk about the buttons on Typekit for a minute. Mm-hmm. I love these buttons. And what are they reminding me of?
The influence from them was originally from a Dieter Rams exhibit that I had seen at the MoMA in San Francisco, where a lot of his industrial design, sort of projectors and appliances for the kitchen and things like that were around. And he just had this incredible ability to put buttons on things. And sometimes they were labeled, sometimes they weren't, sometimes they looked like things, sometimes they were just circles, but they almost always had this playful quality to them that just made you want to interact with them.
They have touchability. You know, there's readability, this is touchability.
Exactly.
You absolutely want to, it's weird. They're like seductive.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that I wanted to get across with them, and this is just a sly little thing with the interface, is that not only do things look like they're actual pictures of what those things are on them, but they're labeled too. So type terminology can be a little obtuse if you're not, at least a little bit familiar with it. So you might not know what some of the terms mean, whether it's X height or contrast or things like that. So not only are things labeled, but you're not just clicking on a link that says a word, you're clicking on a picture of what something looks like. So people are going to learn about type and terminology as they're using this interface.
Are you still happy with Typekit? You're not involved in it anymore, obviously, but still seems like it does the job. Is there anything you would like to wish you could go back and change?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I adore Typekit. I think that it was it really pushed web fonts into the forefront.
Absolutely did. Historically,
But of course, yes, there are tons of things I want to change about. Even while I was there, I did many designs and comps for different areas of the site, different bits of functionality that were explorations and things that we always meant to do. But this gets back to exactly what we were just talking about. Making stuff is hard, and the things that you want to do don't always come before the things that need to be done.
You didn't do the logo, correct?
I did do the logo.
You did do the logo. Yes. Okay.
Yeah,
you knew it had to be. What was the thinking? You knew it had to be type, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get to this strange three-dimensional thingy?
I think one of our original the Typekit logo came out of a brainstorming session when we were still kind of throwing around ideas for names. We had like four or so that were on the table that we were researching the domains for and seeing if we could get them and one of them I think sent me down the direction of thinking about actual punches or metal letter type or letterpress type, and I thought it would be interesting to kind of harken back to something like that as an actual bit of type in relief.
And how did you pick Omnis?
I think that was not even my decision. I think I had collected a bunch of typefaces, one of which was Omnis, and by fantastic type designer Joshua Darden. And everyone just sort of gravitated towards it because it's a beautiful, beautiful typeface. It just has so much friendliness baked into it. It's just such a kind looking typeface. And everyone just gravitated towards it. So I let the sort of consensus make the decision there.
Cool. Where is he's back in, Josh Darden is now, he used to be in Brooklyn, but he's now in like Omaha.
Oh, really? I wasn't aware of that. I thought he was still here.
No, he needs to make more fonts. I haven't seen anything fresh from him for a while.
Does. I thought he might have just come out with something recently. Man, that guy makes italics like no one's business.
I know. They're very sexy.
Yeah. So I really still love Typekit, and I really love that interface, and I'm happy now that Elliot J. Stocks is over there and he is implementing some of the ideas that, you know, were on the table when I was there, but obviously he's giving them a fresh breath and making them even better. So I'm really excited that things are moving ahead with him too.
Yeah. Yep. He's a good guy. Very talented. There's I think your book, it's interesting because there was a time when web design was really a geek province, and there were designers with print backgrounds who sort of, at some of the bigger shops, like a designer with print background would be brought in at the end to comp something after the web people had figured out the user interface and all, you know, and the user flow and all that other stuff. And the information architect had figured out what went on the nav, and they'd done all the, they'd done everything. Then, you know, but for people who were actually doing everything, who were web designers doing everything, this is going to sound egotistical, but I'll just say historically, people like Dan Cederholm or me or Ethan Marcotte and a lot of people, I'm just naming people that you might know, but it was really everybody. A lot of the design background was self-taught out of, you know, as a passion or a hobby or an interest, or you'd been around it in your work, but you hadn't really studied it. And now, we're in an age when people may do their own front-end development, but they're still designers. And I think your work has had a lot to do with switching people. I think your book comes at a really good time, because whether you're someone old school who's transitioning to greater and greater knowledge about design and its basics like typography, or you're someone with a design background who needs to put the web piece together, or you know all that stuff and you just love it and want to geek out. I mean, it's a great book for all three audiences.
That's awesome. Thank you very much. I think that I think you're right. I think that a lot of people came to the web without necessarily a design background, or maybe even any background at all in related things. And that's kind of what's so amazing about the web, is that anyone could just pick something up and teach themselves and be off and running. But the nice thing about writing books like this and you know, people writing posts and giving talks about topics like this is that it gives people that sort of deeper language around things that they have a sense of. And it's probably not dissimilar from, you know, a musician who is self-taught, who doesn't know how to read actual musical notation.
Some of which are the, you know, are amazing. Many of which.
Absolutely. And it's not a requirement.
Rock and punk and hip hop, like there's tremendous talents of people who don't, you know, who don't know what a G clef is.
Right. And I mean, that's just it. This is a creative pursuit. So, you know, a lot of it comes from the gut.
But a well-informed gut always makes better choices.
Absolutely.
So this is, and you're intuitive too. It's not like you sit down and do this like math.
No, right? No. It's I trust a lot of my instincts more than numbers usually.
I've worked with you as a designer and you agonize. And are you still doing that? Are you still agonizing, or are you more?
Oh, I still agonize, okay. Yeah. Okay. I don't think that ever goes away. I think I'd be scared if it went away.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. The book is on web typography, the 11th book from A Book Apart. The designer is Jason Santa Maria. We lost some time in technical difficulties, but this has been really lovely. What's next for you?
Next for me is I'm enjoying writing and not having to deal with a book and just writing for the pleasure of it on my site. But also kind of really getting immersed in more of the Vox Media stuff. I'm very excited with working in a newsroom. It's completely new to me, but kind of at the same time brings together a lot of the stuff that I've worked on in pieces elsewhere.
Is it like HBO's The Newsroom?
No, okay. but there's definitely a vibe to how news flows through it. When something is new, like brand new and just breaking, it's interesting to see how that ripples throughout the company, both in person and virtually.
If you were to leave this gig someday, would you continue to work in editorial design and news? What do you think? Where do you see yourself going in 5 or 10 years?
I honestly don't know. I think that I was a bit frustrated with the prospect of client work or business, starting another business or something like that. So this felt like a very natural transition as something different and exciting, but still in the same field. If it weren't for this, I don't know what I would do. I think I would probably end up taking maybe a breather.
Can you do that?
I would hope so. I mean, take a breather and you know, find income from something else.
Right. There's like, you could become one of those people that makes pastries.
Yeah, I'd have to sit down with a notepad and write down my marketable skills.
You'd agonize over the pastries, though. Don't eat it. Don't eat it. It's not overbaked. Ready yet. It's not ready. Yeah, I worried about you. I'm really glad you connected with Vox Media. I remember thinking, okay, if he doesn't get asked to be the design director at the New York Times, what could that guy do? Because, which, not that you're like not that you're better than anybody else, but you sort of you've been going down a path that has a certain logic to it, and if you're not making the stuff yourself, you have to find a very simpatico employer.
Yep.
Who goes, that's what we don't know how to do that, but that's the thing we're doing, or we do know how to do that, and we need more people who also know how to do that.
Yeah, and I mean, Vox is, wow, I like them from the beginning, but as I've gotten to be there for a while longer, I'm just constantly impressed. They value design so much. It's just top of their list, and they understand. It's like, to be in an organization that large that you never have to explain why design is important, because it's just baked in. I didn't know that that existed, and it's so amazing.
It would be great if no designer ever had to explain that again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, dentists don't really have to explain why you need your teeth and why if your teeth fall out, that's a bad thing. They really don't. Nobody, it's taken for granted.
Yep.
You may like dentists, you may be afraid of dentists, but you know that they exist for a reason. And it's strange that in some places design's worshipped.
Yeah.
But a lot of places, not so much.
Yeah, I think it has an equal seat at the table, and everyone just gets it. It's just understood.
I think to some extent, I would say that there is misogyny and homophobia at the root of some of the disdain for design, because design is understood by many people to be making it pretty. And so it's a domestic skill. It's a women's skill. It's something good gay men are good at. These are like the kind of stereotypes and prejudices that I think are behind some of a business person who doesn't get design or doesn't know why it's important might think, oh yeah, that's like my wife, you know, setting the table. I don't know. I'm picturing Alec Baldwin in 30 Rock.
Right, right.
You know, I don't want to sit at the table with the women and the nice men. Right, he wants to be with the vice presidents, with the sharks.
But I think it's also just maybe on a larger sense that design has been commoditized. I mean, it's not only from the things we see on TV about, you know, makeovers either of your own person or your home, but it seems as though design is something that is easily achieved by just throwing some color around or just cleaning something up a bit. But we don't ever really focus so much on the thinking behind it, the actual conceptual,
right.
You know, gymnastics that happen in order to make something thoughtful or clever or intriguing. And those go way, way deeper than the surface. We've made design into like the surface based commodity.
And then there's this thinking that anyone can do it, because the same way people think anyone can write.
Sure.
Because anyone can type and spell check. Anyone can, you know, anyone can pick colors and fonts.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I worked for a very, very well-known client, one of the first Happy Cog. It didn't go well. It was not a happy association, in part because this company, which is very, very, very well-known, their logo was designed by one of their secretaries in word art, using the fonts that came on Windows, the default fonts that came on Windows. And the boss of this multi-billion dollar multinational corporation had basically asked the secretarial pool, because it might be fun to have a logo, to do that. And the winner got, I don't know, dinner at Red Lobster. I don't really know. Maybe they got a vacation of a week. I don't really know what the winner got, but it's a true story. And it's like, if the top person at the company thinks that the brand and the mark of the brand is something that you give to the girls in the typing pool to do, then, you know, they're probably not going to really be interested in anything you have to say, anything strategic you want to talk about, or let you do anything, and they weren't. And, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's changing, you know?
I think so too. And I think if nothing else, the good design is still going to...
That was me. Sorry.
I think if nothing else, the good design is still just going to rise to the top. And it makes the stuff that is less considered, that is only sort of a surface sheen, you know, it reveals it for that too.
Right. Most people think Apple is, they used to think anyway, oh yeah, you're buying the pretty computer, or, mm-hmm. you know, mine does just the same job. It's just not as pretty as it was. Like, no, that's kind of the least thing that they do in terms of design. The strategy of let's make people want to pay for music when everyone was stealing music. That was a design. Let's change how people relate to music, their personal music. Let's change how they shop for it. I mean, and you know, and by that, from that point of view, Amazon is a designer too. Although you don't go to Amazon's website to look at the pretty.
No, you don't.
Right. Well, I could talk to you all day because you're just great. But we're going to go now.
All right.
So thank you for giving so much time today. Thank you for writing this wonderful book. And listeners, thank you for listening to The Big Web Show. We'll be back with another Big Web Show very soon. Bye-bye.